ongoing talks between Ukraine and Russia have resumed. Over the weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine would be willing to consider becoming a neutral state in order to end the Russian invasion. Ukrainian neutrality is something Russian President Vladimir Putin has long pushed for. But at the same time, Zelensky has stressed that Ukraine must remain sovereign, and he's criticized the U.S. and other Western nations for not doing enough. We're talking about the latest developments in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join us here, 1-800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. needs to send more military supplies and weapons to Ukraine? Should the U.S. not get too involved in what's happening? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us here at Central Time WPR. We're speaking today with Lowell Barrington, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He specializes in post-communist politics. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Molly. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us today to break this down. Now, before we talk about the ceasefire talks, let's talk a little bit about where U.S.-Ukrainian relations stand. And Zelensky has criticized the U.S. and Western Europe for not doing enough. What does he want at this point in time?
That's a good question, because in some ways we continue to hear how pleased Ukrainian officials are with the amount of military support that has come specifically from the United States, and we're also working with them on sharing intelligence information and things like that as well. Obviously, they had talked quite a bit about pushing the West, U.S. and Western Europe and the rest of NATO to do a no-fly zone over Ukraine, although that talk has seemed to it'd been decreasing in the last few days at least. But they would still like much more in terms of support and getting that support as quickly as possible to them, because in some ways, because of their military successes, they're actually using up a lot of the equipment pretty quickly that we have been sending them.
And now, over the weekend, President Biden spoke in Poland. He made comments that the White House has since tried to walk back. Let's listen.
For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power.
So that was President Joe Biden speaking a little bit off the cuff there. Tell us what's happened since then, since he made that remark.
It's interesting because in the United States, a lot of people are just sort of saying there's a Biden being Biden moment, right, that he's known to do that. The problem with it is it does play into Putin's hands a bit in terms of giving him a PR kind of, talking point about the conflict that he has pitched to his own people, both with just a kind of complete fabrication about a genocide looming for ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine, but also really trying to pitch it as about the West really trying to weaken and undermine Russian security. And so when President Biden does say something like that, again, that can be a little useful to Putin in making that claim. I will say it is not great form. I think in general, we don't typically talk about leaders being removed in advance of it happening as at least a U.S. policy. Although I would remind people, too, that his slip up a little earlier when he called, Putin a war criminal, and initially the White House sort of tried to backtrack that. A couple days later, that was official U.S. policy, right, that we're considering him that, and the State Department says that. So it'll be interesting to see whether they try to keep kind of walking it forward a bit in the next few days, or whether they do just hope that it gets dropped and forgotten about.
Saying the quiet part out loud, I feel like, is
right.
So tell us, with these ongoing peace talks, what has come of them so far today?
So two things to note. One you had mentioned earlier, which is the increasing emphasis from the Ukrainian side on the openness to a neutral status for Ukraine that would mean not official membership in NATO, but also not being a part of Russia, obviously, either. And that's a little more complicated in some ways, in that there is with a lot of things related to this conflict, there's a sort of second piece to the story. And it's that he has also said, as part of that neutrality understanding, that there would be security guarantees for Ukraine that would include the U.S. and Europe essentially guaranteeing that Ukrainian sovereignty would be protected, which in practice sounds very much like what would happen if they were a NATO member.
Right.
So I think so it's kind of neutrality, but right. I mean, there's that second piece that's going to be the sticking point, and Russia will not accept any idea of a kind of security guarantee from Europe to protect Ukraine in the future as part of a deal, I don't think, because that's been such a focus for Putin as the, you know, one of the many justifications for this conflict is about NATO's encroachment through Eastern Europe and all the way, you know, with Ukraine on the table as a future member. What Putin sees as coming, you know, right up to the Ukrainian border even more than it already is with the Baltic states. So I think, again, the neutrality one is an interesting concept, and it is one that had been talked about briefly before the invasion. But again, in the case of Ukraine at this point, they aren't going to accept neutrality if Russia can just easily come in again with an invasion. The other interesting story kind of today is about the announcement from Russia that they are kind of pulling back a bit on activities around Kyiv and Chernihiv, which is a city in the far northern part of Ukraine. I think people are getting pretty excited about that in terms of thinking that might show that Russia is starting to back down. My take on that is actually that it is just acknowledging what has been happening on the ground, which is that Russia has been losing in the northern part of the country. They've lost territory to Ukraine around Kyiv, both to the east of Kyiv and to the west of Kyiv. So I think in some ways it's really just a kind of repositioning, regrouping strategy that may involve what they also said, which is they want to focus more on the far eastern part of the country and probably the southeastern part of the country rather than Kyiv. But again, that's as much as anything an acknowledgement, I think, that they just realized they were not going to be able to take Kyiv, maybe not even after, you know, weeks and weeks of fighting. They just might not be able to take it at all at this point.
So where does this leave the two sides in the conflict?
Well, again, I don't think we should expect it to end immediately. I mean, it's great that there are talks, that it is always good to have negotiations. You never know what's going to come out of them. So you always want to go through, even if it seems like you're going through the motions, you want to do that because it could be that some piece of something ends up, you know, working out as an agreement later. But the challenge for both Putin and Zelensky here is what is their outcome that they're okay with that overlaps with the other ones. And I just don't see where that is right now for either of them. Putin can't pull back all the way to kind of where they were before the invasion, I don't think. And at this point, Ukraine's actually talking about that's not even enough for them. They want Crimea and the eastern, you know, parts of Donetsk and Luhansk back as well. So I don't see a lot of overlap there. But again, we'll see down the road. If Russia continues to take more losses, there may be a point at which either Putin is pressured to or just decides that it is better to withdraw and then just use his massive, you know, propaganda machine back in Russia to try to spin it as a win.
We're speaking with Professor Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor at the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, and we have a call for you. We are going to go to the phones and speak with George in Ashland. Good afternoon, George.
Good afternoon. I had two parts to my questions. One I would call Quebec and the Donbass, another one I call Hong Kong and Sevastopol. So firstly, would it be helpful if the Ukrainians would focus more on healing the cultural divisions between the Russian-speaking and Ukrainian-speaking populations of some of their districts, heal that cultural divide? And it reminds me of the separatist movement of Quebec years ago, French-speaking culture versus English-speaking culture. So would that be helpful? The second question is, Hong Kong and Sevastopol, doesn't strike me that the Russian military will ever give up Sevastopol. So why can't the Ukrainians lease it to the Russians for like 500 years, kind of like the British leased Hong Kong for the Chinese, and therefore the Ukrainians don't give up their sovereignty, but they've made a deal that maybe works.
All right. Thanks for the call, George. Lowell.
So, George, those are both really interesting questions. I'm going to start with the second one. I think it's the quicker answer, which is that I would expect there would be some kind of agreement like that in any outcome that gives Ukraine territory back that Russia has seized. It's actually hard to imagine easily, at least, that Russia gives up Crimea, even if things continue to go really badly with the conflict. Crimea has actually been brought into the Russian political system as a republic within the Russian Federation. So that's a hard one to see. But if it were, I would agree that they would absolutely push for Sevastopol to be a military base with Russians there. And other countries around Russia have done that kind of agreement where they've allowed Russian troops to remain. So I think that, that does make some sense. The analogy with Quebec and the far east of Ukraine is an interesting one. I think one of the things that in my work and a lot of others who've done a lot of work with survey data in Ukraine in the last few years have noticed is that the point that's raised about sort of finding a place for the Russian language is still important, and those are important talks to have. But one of the things we've been seeing is that that line in Ukraine between the people who sort of look toward Russia as a place that they're feeling very connected and attached to and those who look to Europe, that that line has moved eastward dramatically, and it did that after 2014, and it's continuing to do that, so that in the surveys that we've done, one of the things we've seen is a lot fewer people who declare that they are ethnically Russian or say that they are Russian only speaking. And then, in fact, a lot of people are now saying they speak both languages, or even saying they're kind of Russian and Ukrainian, not just Russian, in the eastern part of the country. So I think that that's always going to be an issue about, you know, debates about street signs and what language they're in schools and what language that should be the language of instruction and things like that. And those talks will continue in eastern Ukraine. But again, I think that one of the things we have to acknowledge is, and one of the other people who work on general population attitudes in Ukraine put it, that Ukraine has become much more Ukrainian. And by that, he means the language has been taken up more in the east than it used to be. And there's also pretty strong emerging sense of a kind of overarching Ukrainian civic national identity that had been forming, but again, sped up after 2014, and I think is really speeding up now, partly because, and it's one of the stranger parts of this conflict, that the areas that the Russian troops have attacked in some ways most forcefully have been in a lot of ways the most ethnically Russian or at least Russian-speaking parts of the country.
Right, right. Lowell Barrington is associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. We are speaking about Ukraine. What do you want to know about what's happening in Ukraine right now? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're speaking with Marquette University political scientist Lowell Barrington about what's happening in the Ukraine-Russia conflict. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-642-1234. And Lowell, I want to go to the phones right now. I want to speak with Marcus in Milwaukee with a question that, picking up on something you said earlier about potential for other alliances with Ukraine. Good afternoon, Marcus.
Hi. Hi, Professor Barrington. So my question, I guess that what I'm wondering is, why doesn't the U.S. look to perhaps like try and set up some sort of other system of alliance kind of similar to how we have NATO, except that it would consist of countries more like Norway, Sweden, and Finland, like that type of model, since the Russians already seem to be okay with them not being a part of NATO, but having some sort of mutual assistance pack, you know, if they were to be invaded, and see if we couldn't roll Ukraine into that so that it's kind of like a regional group with similar interests. So that way it can kind of sidestep the NATO issue. And it's also something that apparently the Russians seem to have been okay with thus far. So why not try and create some other, you know, Northern North Atlantic Treaty Organization or something? I don't know what you call it, but
thanks, Marcus.
That's a great question. I think part of the answer there is that there also has to be an incentive for those other countries. And if you are Finland and Sweden, for example, the idea that you would want to get into an agreement to guarantee that you would intervene against Russia if it attacked Ukraine again in the future seems to be something that it would be not necessarily in their interest to do, because they would potentially be drawn into a significant conflict that they, you know, may struggle with. So I like the idea. I think in practice, it's finding the incentives for the other countries. The second quick piece, though, is that there is at least a non-trivial chance that both Finland and Sweden will be NATO members down the road. I think that on the long list of things that Putin's invasion of Ukraine has done, has really made it obvious to Europe how important and relevant NATO is? And I think it is, I mean, in both countries it's being talked about. I think it's quite likely that they will pursue NATO membership actually in Finland and Sweden. And I think that at this point in time, at least, there's no reason to think of Ukraine being able to join NATO anytime soon, just because they have been so destabilized, and the invasion has done one thing for Putin, which is to show that he can, in fact, destabilize Ukraine if they were to ever, you know, think about getting serious again about a NATO membership.
Which arguably was the goal, one of the goals.
Right, and that way he's won, right? He won in taking NATO membership for Ukraine off the table. That is not going to be anything that's going to happen in the near future. On the other hand, again, there is the tally sheet, you know, that's one of his only wins, right? And then there's this huge number of things that have been really important losses for him in this that I don't think, you know, he's happy with the way that the balance on the two sides of that tally sheet go.
Yeah. I want to go back to the phones. We have a caller, Gary, in Madison with a question about refugees and the visa process. Good afternoon, Gary.
Good afternoon. My question is about the 100,000 visas that President Biden has announced that he's going to make available to Ukrainian refugees. But if you go to the State Department website, number one, the embassy in Kiev is closed. Number two, you can't apply for a refugee or that visa in the embassy in Warsaw. You have to go to Frankfurt, Germany to apply for those visas. So my question is the administration really sincere about this, or is this just public relations posturing?
So, Gary, I think that they are sincere. Some of those details may be able to get worked out down the road. It may be that we could end up doing this in Poland instead of Germany. But there are so many refugees right now that, in fact, a large number of them will end up making their way to Germany. There's actually reports of Ukrainian refugees showing up at the southern border in Mexico and requesting to become part of that process already. So, you know, that's another way we might think about it. They may find other ways to try to get closer to the United States. But in the meantime, again, Germany is also bracing for the number of refugees that have gone into Poland, for example. They can't all stay in Poland. Poland can't handle that many people, and even in some ways Hungary and Romania are looking to send some of those refugees farther west. So I think the part of the process of being an alliance is, yes, we have to take seriously the idea that we are going to accept refugees. That if we don't do that and we get a refugee crisis in Europe, that's one of the ways that this really impressive unity that's been developed between the United States and Western Europe could start breaking down, as if there's just a massive refugee humanitarian crisis and we're not playing a role to help that.
Mm-hmm. Good question. When we've got calls are pouring in, I want to take next Mike from Waukesha. Good afternoon.
Hi,
Mike.
Hello, good afternoon. Social media, there's a buzz going around, and there's these foolish questions, I think. It asks, you know, would this have happened under President Trump's watch? And in fact, I think President Trump partially caused this, because when he tried to back us away from NATO, this emboldened Putin. The other thing is I think it was going to happen anyway. There probably would have been less bloodshed, but then either way, then Russia would have tried to get what it wanted. I just wonder what your guest comments are. Thank you.
Thanks. Lowell.
Well, Mike, I agree with you to an extent in that I think one of the things that Putin saw going into this was at least he believed that Europe and the United States would not be united in a response. And that was partly because of how bad relations had become between the United States and Europe leading up to 2020. But at the same time, I also want to say that the timing also relates to the idea that since President Biden has been in office, that there was renewed talk of Ukraine becoming a NATO member. So I don't want to say it's only a problem prior to the administration. I shouldn't say problem, but it's not just a cause of the bad relations in the past. It's a combination of the fact that Putin believed that Europe would not be able to be united. And you know, and again, if we think about, if I told people before the war that, you know, we're going to help figure out how to bring Germany, France, and the UK together along with us to bring all these countries together. And on top of that, you know, Switzerland is going to impose economic sanctions. I mean, just the number of things that have been able to happen in the united response have been really impressive. But again, that took a lot of work, because where Mike is right is that there was significant damage done to our relations with Europe in the previous administration. And I think that we need to acknowledge the Biden administration has done a very effective job at putting together this this alliance right now in terms of its economic responses and military support for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Unprecedented. Well, Lowell, we're almost out of time, but I would love to hear what you are watching for out of these peace talks.
I don't think I'm very optimistic about them, I guess is what I would say. They're important. Again, I think they should be happening, and anytime you get sides together, it's a good thing. But the real question, again, is what are the off-ramps that Putin could find acceptable that Zelensky also can accept and would be politically possible in Ukraine? And that's the really tricky part here, is that Zelensky has done this amazing job of rallying the Ukrainian people, but he's done it by the idea that we're not going to surrender an inch of this territory. And so for him now to take that step toward a deal that might involve, in fact, acknowledging that Russia is going to control territory in Ukraine, that's going to be very difficult for him to do. But for Putin, there's no real incentive for him to withdraw, even with the losses they're taking, unless there's something he can point to as a territorial or some kind of situation that was better than it was when the invasion started. So I think that's one thing to look for, is just, are there any opportunities where you see something that kind of overlaps between the two positions? The only other thing to keep an eye on is whether we start seeing cracks within the Russian government and you start seeing more criticism or more acknowledgement of the number of losses. But I think it's a slightly conservative estimate, but there are likely at least 15,000 Russian troops that have been killed so far in a month in this conflict. That is, you know, 500 a day. It's an incredible number of losses. And that, along with the economic problems, will certainly put at least some pressure on Putin going forward.
Well, Lowell Barrington, we will be watching. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Molly.
We've been speaking with Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University.